right, everyone. It is Monday, December 30th, the last Monday of 2019, as we start to get ready to gallop into 2020, a year of fear, frustration, anticipation. I feel like there's so much on the line right now as we look at 2020. A little bit about the weather out there, since I always have to give the Concord Weather Report. That's why you love The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And that is, it's not snowing, it's crunching ice. It's just disgusting out there. It's heavy, it's thick, it's slippery, it's depressing. Anyway, but that is our weather for December 30th. And one of our listeners, who used to listen to me in Texas, actually, and now has moved to Michigan, just sent me a story, Ken Barnes.
Yeah.
And I was commenting on how on the affluent and how much money they made in 2019 and how they have really sort of they've rigged the system to benefit themselves and to undermine the rest of us. And he did send me a lovely story and said maybe this is where they could spend some of their wealth. And it was one of the guys from Home Depot. See, one of the guys is a real schmuck and the other guy is kind of a good guy at Home Depot. But the good guy at Home Depot has given his money to NYU, and the title of the piece is How the NYU School of Medicine is Going Tuition-Free.
Whoa.
Tuition-free.
Wow.
He is, I mean, we're talking about people who, you know, think about incurring $200,000, $300,000 worth of debt,
yeah,
who change their lives and sometimes don't even decide not to go because they're not quite sure that they can, you know, accept the burden or they don't become the kind of doctors they want to become because of this enormous thing. And Tag, I love you, Tag Butler. Tag Butler just sent me a note and said, Arnie, what about this? Maybe this is what some people can do. Ken Langone and the NYU Free Medical School is a great example of putting money where your values are. He made his money at Home Depot. And I just wrote him back and wrote, wow, an amazing story. And you know what this reminds me of? This is I have a variation on a theme. My aunt used to work for one of the rich, for at the time, the richest guy in the world. Before, this was the 1960s. His name was Leonard Davis. He was the founder of Colonial Penn Life Insurance. He was the founder of a lot of other companies. He funded all these geriatric hospitals. If you look back into the old archives, despite some of his bad behavior, he was actually the founder of the AARP. Okay? This is so interesting. But she worked for him. She was the CEO of one of his companies. And his wife, Sophie Davis, was a kid from the streets of New York. And Sophie Davis created the Sophie Davis Medical School at City University of New York. And the Sophie Davis Medical School basically says, if you stay in New York City and work within the medical field for 5 years, you don't incur any tuition. And she did this years ago. Years ago. It's now becoming more of a thing. But back then, Sophie realized if she was to give back to the city that brought her all this opportunity and gave her a family and a life and a hope, she needed to pay it back. And it was the most vulnerable that needed health care. And that was what she did. So I read these stories and I feel like I have a connection in an interesting way. And it was the Sophie Davis Medical School. You should just check it out. Anyway, so what are impressive. Your thoughts for today for our Rethink the Week? But this was my rethink from Tag Butler. So thank you, Tag.
That's great. I am going to talk about a story written by a guy named Noah Leonard, who I'm going to give a shout out to, L-A-N-A-R-D. He wrote this great story, several of them actually, about the border. And this one was 2 days ago that talked about how much the southwest border of the United States has changed in just the year 2019.
Okay.
Here we are at the end of December, the year goes out. But when 2019 began, from January through May, basically, the number of families crossing the border skyrocketed. And then starting in May, when one of Trump's hateful policies, the return to Mexico policy, was approved by the court, all of a sudden sent 60,000 people back to Mexico. The first half of the year, Central American parents and children, and the Flores decision had said that they couldn't detain children for more than 20 days and they had to abide by certain standards for the kids. And so when that decision came down, a lot of Central American families started coming up to the U.S. border instead of adult males usually.
Okay.
So it was single males that were coming
and
they
families.
Dropped off and now it's families. So the people that you look at are not the people that Donald Trump talks about. They really are families, mm-hmm. and they're fleeing for their lives, mm-hmm. the violence, and they have young children with them, and they get to the border. And then starting in May, the Remain in Mexico policy forces them to go back over the border into Mexico, even though they have a legal right to come into the U.S. and mm-hmm. file their asylum claims and wait in the U.S. for their asylum claims to be heard. So they're back over the border living in these unsanitary tent camps, and they're living right across the border, kind of almost like huddling up against the wall of the Trump's border wall,
right.
in order to be a little, hopefully a little bit safer in numbers,
right.
rather than going further away from the actual wall where uh-huh. they're going to be preyed upon by all the violence and the rapists and mm-hmm. the kidnappers and everything. Also, a change was that it used to be Mexican people who were trying to immigrate to the U.S., and now it's the Central American people from the Northern Triangle countries who are fleeing the violence mm-hmm. that is down there, violence that is down there in large part because of U.S.
policy.
Foreign policy down there to install and arm
right.
dictators and totalitarian governments. But
we reap what we sow.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also it was interesting to me that the crossings this year, the huge increase, was not evenly distributed, that the vast majority of them were in Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley and in El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
So in El Paso, only 212 family members were stopped in October of 2017. And this year, in May of 2019, the number was nearly 30,000.
Oh, my God.
From 212 families to 30,000 families in 1 month.
That's just shocking. That's just shocking.
So you wonder why this increase and then the response from the Trump government, why is there severe overcrowding in border facilities?
Yeah.
And then starting in May is when the first of six children died after entering Border Patrol custody.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't care.
No, he doesn't care. But these were the first kids to die in U.S. custody in more than a decade. 10 years.
To him, it's kind of a message. He actually likes the death because the death sends a message. Send more will die. Send more will die. Because he has absolutely – he doesn't value their lives. He sees them as expendable. And he sees it in a bizarre, evil way as mm-hmm. sending the message he wants to send. You come here – you don't necessarily survive here. Oh, my God.
So one other thing that is a word that people may have heard but might not recognize is the word metering, M-E-T-E-R, mm-hmm. metering. So I mentioned that in 1 month this year, the number of families crossing increased from 212 to 30,000. So huge surge in people. But the number of people who the U.S. government allows to request asylum at the official border crossings stayed constant. So that's the metering. They have a constant number. They're only going to actually see people at the border to officially request asylum to the same number that we had when there were only 212 families coming instead of 30,000 families coming. So these other 29,788 families have to wait somewhere else. And then, of course, they just keep building up and building up and building up.
All right.
So
I'm not – how can I say that I'm surprised by anything that comes up?
That's the year in immigration. Right, as you know, that's
right.
one
it's,
of my
– It's your passion.
Passions,
absolutely,
yes.
Absolutely. Actually, it's very interesting.
And I'm going down there in about a week or 10 days.
Okay, good, so. Good. Well, we're still waiting for Dean Spiliotis, but we're about to grab Stephen Pimper, who is – a homeless expert, a fellow at the Carsey Institute, teaches at UNH, and he will be joining us. I see Dean Spiliotis showing up right now. So we were just talking on the air, Dean, with Ken, and he was talking about what's happened with the whole immigration policy in the United States and the inhumanity of the Bush administration, which is sadly nothing shocking about that anymore. It's just more predictability. And I saw a fascinating story that actually I wasn't going to talk about right away, but given the fact that Ken has sort of laid the foundation, I think it's an appropriate one. It's a piece out of Vox.com. And the piece out of Vox.com, listen to the title. Let me grab Stephen Pimper. Stephen Pimper is now joining us by phone. He is a homeless expert, a fellow at the Carsey Institute, and a professor at UNH in Manchester. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Hi, Arnie.
All right. So we were just talking about what's happened at the border and the border policy and how it's changed and how 2019 was a year of change at the border because of Trump's inhumane policies. But the piece that I wanted to bring up with both you and Dean was the following. Listen to the title. One Surprisingly Simple Reason Evangelicals Love Trump. Ready? Their answer, it's his immigration policy. Think about this. It's his immigration policy. And then the question at Vox.com is, why are white evangelicals so devoted to President Trump? It's a question that has preoccupied many academics and political observers. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and a contender, tweeted that Jesus Christ came into this world not as a citizen but as a refugee. But what they have started to begin to realize is that the whole rationale for these white evangelicals is that they are incredibly conservative on immigration. And I suspect, Dean Spiliotis, that what they want to do is keep America white. And what they see with immigration policy and what Donald Trump has done something to sort of reinsure that the nation as it goes forward is a nation that continues to look like them, preach like them, pray like them, and immigration is a threat to that.
Well, I'm not even so sure that they believe that President Trump prays with them or shares similar set of values. And it's interesting. My sense is that people often think that evangelicals are kind of value-driven rather than outcome-driven. And I think what we've seen in the last few years is that they're as outcome-driven as any other group of political actors. And so they've essentially made a bargain with President Trump that he would pursue particular outcomes on courts and the administrative state and a variety of other – and immigration and a variety of other matters in exchange for at least most of them, if not all, overlooking his personal behavior, his temperament, all the kinds of things that we traditionally think of as not being godly in nature.
Right.
And so they've taken that deal. And they seem very happy with the outcomes that he's been generating
But I think, Stephen, I think what I think is that they see his outcomes as godly. Not necessarily his behavior,
outcomes.
Right, and so one of the pieces out of this article from Vox.com was that the conservative position of evangelicals on immigration issues was somewhat shocking, where they found that evangelical Protestants were 75% more likely than all Republicans to assert the following statement. You ready? Immigrants are invading American society. So there you go. Just using the term, it's an invasion, Stephen.
So we've gone back and forth here, but I think in this instance, it's really important that every time we say evangelicals or Protestant, we say white evangelicals Protestants.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Because that's an important distinction that we need to draw here. This is also not anything that is actually particularly new. There is a very large body of scholarship trying to make sense of the rise of the political right that starts somewhere around the mid-1970s or so.
Right.
And there are two strains in that literature. One of them looks at the rise of business interests, right, and the sort of the increasing influence of corporate interests and rich individuals in the American political system. The other looks at the rise of what started calling itself the moral majority, right, the rise of religious denominations that had previously worked hard to remain apolitical but saw that the path to their own power and influence had to go through the political system. And one of the things that we have seen since the mid-70s is the convergence of that economic right and that religious right. So going back to something that you were both referencing earlier, it is, I think, a mistake to think of a lot of these white evangelicals as driven by religion or God. They are driven by power and influence and then back their way into religious rationales for their preferred outcome.
Well, and their power and influence is about ensuring the future of their status quo.
Yep.
And everything that they're doing right now is to ensure that status quo, which I just think is so fascinating. But and of course, the idea that, that Jesus was a refugee is just something that they not only cannot tolerate, but they've never accepted anyway. It's just it is so fascinating that the man that they claim to be, the Son of Christ, basically sort of fills in all those gaps in what they should be believing but don't believe. You know,
yeah, like, really,
he's the wrong figure is what I'm trying to
say.
Yeah,
and Stephen's right. I mean, this really goes back to the early 1980s, the rise of the moral majority, Jerry Falwell, for the first time realizing that they could wield political power. You saw the rise of Heritage Foundation, these conservative
think tanks. Ralph Reed was the other one.
These conservative – Gary Bauer, these conservative think tanks that doubled as kind of policy and political – outfits. And so really this has been out there now for, you know, 30, almost 40 years.
But you know what's so amazing is I don't think anybody quite believed it. I remember I attended a meeting where Ralph Reed spoke in 1990, Stephen. And basically what he said was by the end of the decade, we will control at least 2/3 of the Republican parties in the United States. He actually accomplished it long before the end of the 1990s. I mean, he was wildly successful very early on. And people actually heard this and thought that that was not possible. But it turned out that it was incredibly possible, which is what I thought was so shocking. So the other story that is we're talking about the immigration story and we're talking about white evangelicals. Thank you. I will make sure that I keep saying that. I'm probably going to talk about this tomorrow as well because I am so apoptic. So I got a call. Just let me start with the foundation for this. I got a call from Pedro at C-SPAN. And I'm going to be the first guest of 2020 on New Year's Day on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. And he asked me, what did I want to talk about? Okay? So I said to Pedro, please do me a favor, call me, because I have an idea that I want to talk about this, because I think this talks both about 2020, it reflects on 2019, it reflects on the presidential campaign, it reflects on sort of the state of our economic status in the world. And this is the story that I was quoting from. So New York Magazine, and he had actually seen the same piece. New York Magazine had a headline. You ready for this, gentlemen? The world's 500 richest people increased their wealth. This is not their total wealth. They just increased their wealth by $1.2 trillion in 2019. This is an increase, Mr. Pimper. This is an increase, Mr. Spiliotis. This is not where they started. They increased their wealth by that amount of money. So here's what I posted on Facebook, and I read this to the guys at C-SPAN this morning. I said, as the world enters the climate crisis with a vengeance, the rich amass more wealth. Was this the plan? They ensure their safety with a moat of trillions, protecting them as they continue to drive the rest of the planet into a future of fire, floods, and famine with money-making schemes that accelerate our demise. So I'll start with you, Stephen. But that's kind of how I feel, you know. And instead of us basically abandoning fossil fuels, I almost feel like fossil fuels are getting a bigger license to do more damage and do it faster. When I'm kind of looking at – I'm even looking at Amazon right now and Amazon's idea of moving packages faster and faster and faster. So not only are people expendable, but now think about the amount of carbon that you are now, you know, adding to the environment by moving all those packages in a million different directions. So people can have instant gratification and get their package in 6 hours. I mean, think of all this stuff that when you actually calculate what they're doing, not only are they making more money, but they're even doing more destructive things to the environment, Stephen.
Yeah. And I think this is, you know, at the very least, a failure of 21st century capitalism and a failure of democracy, right? It sort of belies the notion that the market is self-regulating and that the sort of human flourishing can emerge from operations of the market left unfettered, but is, of course, an absolute deep and profound failure of American democracy. 10 out of those richest 15 on the planet are Americans, who themselves have somewhere in the neighborhood just shy of $1 trillion in wealth among them.
Yeah.
And that I think this is this sort of this failure of democracy that, not coincidentally, I think has coincided with this rise of the political right from the 70s and 80s. Right? Remember that in the post-war period, the economy was growing at a much faster rate than it is right now, and the benefits of that economy were more or less being roughly evenly distributed across income groups. Right. Whereas now we've got less growth overall in the economy, and the overwhelming majority of that growth is inuring only to the benefit of a narrower and narrower segment of the population who seem to feel perfectly comfortable in relegating millions to function as climate refugees, to disrupt world food systems, to completely unhinge democratic structures if it will narrowly benefit them and their cronies. And the last point that I would say is that I think this fits in very nicely with what we're seeing about the increased reporting of the elimination of science and regulation in the Trump administration. If we think of the Trump administration as itself a smash-and-grab operation on behalf of rich old people, then this, in its way, makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dean, I saw this story, and I kept thinking, their increase in wealth was $1.2 trillion.
It's a lot of money begets a lot of money. Well, how it works.
Well, that's exactly. Well, and then you go look at the market.
Just the interest in the market. That is tremendous.
And nobody is working for that money.
Right. Nobody exactly. Not only is nobody working for that money, but when you realize that the top 1% control 50% of the market, the top 10% control 84% of the market. Yeah. I want to scream at people about saying, "Oh, but I have a 401k, honey bun." Your 401k fits into a thimble. The benefit that you are getting in your 401k compared to the 1% and the top 10% is de minimis at best. And this is because they've gotten rid of everything else that you've depended on for your retirement.
But I just say that not just the amount, the absolute amount, but the rate of increase of wealth and inequality of wealth is just astonishing. If Arnie's number is correct, that the increase alone in 1 year was $1.2 trillion for five people.
500. No, 500. That's
I'm sorry, 500 people.
Right.
Then
it's still a lot of money.
But Stephen was talking about the top 15 people, and they don't together own a whole lot more than, well, it's under $10 trillion, right, or something along those lines. To increase by $1.2 trillion is a huge amount of increase. And if you're right, wealth begets wealth, but it begets it in an exponential way.
Right.
And, you know, next year it'll increase instead of by $1.2 trillion, by $2.2 trillion.
But let me just say something, Dee. You know what this reminds me of? The increase in wealth reminds me of something else that we're seeing, which is the how we are seeing climate change basically changing faster, and it's like a whirling dervish. It's getting faster and faster, and with each, it's no longer in our control. The wealth right now is now out of control, and the wealth begets wealth, begets wealth, begets wealth. Well, that's also what's happening with climate almost simultaneously.
Well, I mean, there are a number of different ways that we could take this discussion, but, you know, I will say that the part of the issue is that to the extent that any of these big companies, like you mentioned, Amazon, what they will say is that we're working towards, you know, we're using, battery operated drone technology is the future. Driverless electric trucks. So there are all these ways in which, sort of in theory, but the problem is that overcoming technological and financial hurdles, it's, as you were saying, everything else is accelerating so quickly that it's nice to think about that stuff.
But
the speed is just not, it's either they're not committed to it the way they say, or it's just technologically just takes too long to do it. I will say that, you know, the bigger issue here is, I'm thinking about this in policy terms, is that we're talking about a system that generates these geometric increases in wealth on its own. So, well, you know, how do you fix the system, or what do you do? It's going to require changes to the tax code, tax structure.
Right.
You know, you need
and
a democratic.
There's no will for that.
Yeah, there's no will for that. If you go too far in the opposite direction in terms of redistribution of wealth, you know, the Democratic candidate will be branded a communist, and then you're going to lose independence. So it's sort of what do you do? What can you realistically do to this recognition that the system is not working?
Well, but
what's equitable, and what do you mean by equitable? And it's a very difficult thing to unpack.
To define. Yes, Steve?
I mean, the Democratic candidate is going to be branded a communist regardless
of
what their
that
policies
is true.
Are.
That
so
is
I think
true.
That's immaterial.
But I think there Stephen, I disagree. I think there are levels at which it either sticks or does not stick.
You're more socialist and less socialist.
Well, the way it'll stick with certain voters, I'm not talking about Republicans. Yeah. I'm talking more about, you know, kind of independents or maybe people who voted for who were Republican who did not vote for who voted for Democrat in the midterm election in 2018.
And won't vote for 2018.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Well, Stephen,
so, I mean, I'm not convinced, but I think there's a larger problem here, and that is as we see that sort of accelerated accumulation of capital, given the way in which the American political system advantages money over people, right? The risk, and this goes back to right Thomas Piketty's argument that right. he made in sort of the big thick economics right. book from last year, that as we see capital grow, its influence on the political system grows and closes out more and more opportunities for genuine democratic influence. I am more worried about that than I am by sort of impressions that individual voters have, because I'm increasingly concerned that it does not matter what those voters think or want, because we're erecting increasingly a political system that is working towards shutting them out entirely.
So then the democratic system doesn't exist. With the kind of wealth accumulation that we are seeing, it is the antithesis of what it is we will need in order to have democratic institutions, in order to have rule by the majority, in order to engage voters. Because what this accumulation of wealth has done has basically shut down virtually every lever of how we define democracy. You know, is that what you're telling me? There was an amazing another piece. We're going to have to get to it all on the back end when we come back for the Rethink the Week. Let me just read you the headline, and you will understand why when we come back it adds to the conversation about wealth. This was from the New York Times of the 27th. In the United States, an angioplasty cost $32,000. Elsewhere, maybe $6,000. A study of international prices finds American patients pay much more across a wide array of common services. When we get back from the break, I'm going to read you a paragraph in this article that says it all. Not only are we seeing this amount of wealth that is now undermining democracy, we are seeing the accumulated wealth in the current private health system that is now making it impossible for us to fix our American health system. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and Ken Barnes is our producer. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day President Richard Nixon signed the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act into law. At least three key events served as the impetus for the legislation. Beginning in the mid-1960s, miners began staging numerous health and safety walkouts across the Appalachian coal fields. Their working conditions were despicable. Then, in November 1968, 78 miners were killed in a methane and coal dust explosion at Console Mine No. 9 in Farmington, West Virginia. Miners were outraged when United Mine Workers leader Tony Boyle provided cover for the company's murderous negligence. Then, in January, thousands of miners rallied in West Virginia's state capitol, along with the Black Lung Association and the disabled miners and widows. They demanded legislation controlling coal dust and compensating black lung victims. When the hearings dragged on, 30,000 miners walked out in a wildcat strike the next month in what is referred to as the 1969 Black Lung Strike. By March, the number would increase to 40,000. The state law passed on March 12. Fears of a nationwide health and safety wildcat strike prompted Congress to craft and pass the federal legislation. According to historian Paul Niden, the West Virginia Black Lung Strike was the longest political strike in modern U.S. labor history. The act created the Mine Safety and Health Administration. It mandated annual inspections and increased federal powers of enforcement. The Coal Act also required monetary penalties for all violations and established criminal penalties for knowing and willful violations. The act developed improved mandatory health and safety standards and provided compensation for miners disabled by black lung disease. Miners continue to fight for better conditions, enforcement, and compensation to this day. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Let's celebrate a legislative victory for common sense, public safety, and civil rights, all three, all in one law. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. New Jersey recently passed a law that provides that being undocumented will no longer prohibit an otherwise qualified person from obtaining a driver's license. The bill promotes public safety by ensuring that drivers are knowledgeable about the rules of the road and that they can competently drive a vehicle. And it ensures that the cars are insured. And through title and license fees, it will generate some $21 million for the state in the next 3 years. The bill makes common sense because a car can be a necessity to get to a job, to take the kids to a doctor's appointment for myriad reasons. And we want drivers licensed and cars insured. And the law is a victory for civil rights and liberties because it will eliminate persons being dragged into the court and criminal process for an action driving a car that simply need not be criminal. In passing this law, New Jersey is not an outlier. It is not the first state. It is the 15th state to pass such a law. And other states are considering similar legislation, such as Massachusetts, where the Work and Family Mobility Act is before the legislature. Common sense, public safety, and civil rights all promoted in one bill. This is legislation whose time has come. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
Immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in, let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and break? I can stay another. Man, I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway.
All right, everyone, we are back. This is our Rethink the Week with the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It is Monday, December 30th, the last Monday of 2019. In studio with us is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Joining us by phone is Stephen Pimper. He is a homeless expert. He is with the Carsey Institute on public policy. He also teaches at UNH Manchester. So you played the song Immigration Man. Remind us, Ken, who sings it?
That is Graham Nash and David Crosby, and I played it in part because of my riff at the beginning, and also I saw that you're going to be talking about immigration.
I am.
In the next part of the show.
Well, and so I want to talk a little bit about the angioplasty, but before I do this, let me just share a really quick immigration story. So I want you to, you know, give me some point of opportunity here, Dean Spiliotis and Stephen. I'm at the clerk's office at City Hall in Concord, okay, Steve? And I asked the city clerk if I could have the mayor's cell phone because I want to talk to the mayor because I want to pitch the mayor a story. And she says, okay, what do you want to tell him? And there's a really attractive, beautiful woman, probably in her late 30s, early 40s, standing next to me. Don't know who she is. And so I said to him, I said to the clerk, I said, I was at the International Festival this summer. And at the International Festival, there were people from all over the world. They were in their costumes. They were making their food. They were dancing, and they brought their music from Nepal and Scotland. It was just amazing. And I said, and I was sitting on the steps because I was trying to get out of the heat of the State House, and I'm watching this display of humanity, and it was just remarkable. And I said to her, I said, never in my life did I feel so patriotic. I never felt so American as I did that day seeing this display of every country in the world. And what brought us together was this idea. All right? I said, and as you were driving into Concord, they had taken every country of the world and put flags of every country of the world on Main Street. And so here's my dream, Mr. Pimper. My dream is that a week before every election, that they roll out those flags from every country in the world and they display it on Main Street, because out of many comes one, which is Election Day. Mm. So I'm telling this story, and all of a sudden the city clerk says, you need to introduce yourself to the woman standing next to you. And I said, why? And she said, she just became an American citizen. She was from Turkey, and she had lived in this country, and she now lives in Concord, and she suddenly realized, this is home. And there I was telling the story, and we almost started crying because it was like, how did you know? And of course, I didn't know. But that was That's the power of immigration. And almost everyone at the city clerk's office, we all wanted to start hugging each other because it was a celebration of who we are. So anyway, now I was mentioning the story about the angioplasties, okay? And that actually is an international story as well. And the fact is they did a study of international prices and they found that American patients pay much more across a wide array of common services from every kind of possible, from imaging to whatever. And so during the course of reading the article, I saw a paragraph that just completely jumped out at me because, again, it goes back to sort of the accumulation of wealth and money, and these two stories connect. So, Dean, here's the two sentences. Patients and insurance companies in the United States pay higher prices for medication, imaging testing, basic health visits, and common operations. Those high prices make healthcare in the U.S. extremely expensive. And now this is the language I want everyone to take notes. And they also finance a robust and politically powerful healthcare industry, which means lowering prices will always be hard, if not impossible. And so, Dean, as I'm reading this story, you know, everybody's poo-pooing Medicare for All. You hear nothing but it being trashed. I don't care whether you're listening to MSNBC or CNN, and they're all talking about everybody wants to keep their health insurance, and I want that choice, and give me that deductible, and I embrace my copay, and all this other crap. Mm-hmm. And I am reading this, and that story talks about how powerful they are. They don't just manipulate the power players in Washington. They frankly manipulate the kind of media conversation that we hear that just reinforces their ability to continue charging more and charging more, not with a better outcome, but just with more, I think, financial depletion on the part of the American people.
Well, you know, cost has always been the other side of the equation from coverage. And, you know, going back all the way to the Clintons and their attempt in the early 90s, and then certainly with President Obama and the Affordable Care Act, you know, so much focus was on, you know, how do you make sure that everyone has coverage, and should there not be a mandate that you have to have coverage? But part of the big challenge here is to lower cost. And you see, you know, your stuff you were reading is suggesting that obviously the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry and that whole industry has an incentive to – they have right. no incentive
None.
To lower
None.
Costs, right? And
None.
The concern I think that people have had with Medicare is they hear stories from two things. They hear stories from hospitals and doctors who say Medicare for All, you know, we can't possibly survive or provide the kind of care we need to provide on the kind of reimbursement we would be getting from the federal government. So that, you know, that's the one thing. And the other thing is – people's concerns, fair or, you know, reasonable or not, that they won't be able to have the tests they want. You remember the death panels back
yeah,
with it, with a, you know, some committee's going to decide whether or not you can have an MRI. I mean, that kind of stuff. So cost is really difficult, but we always spend most of our time talking about
coverage.
The cost side of the equation.
I mean, and so the language, Stephen, is this. Researchers at Harvard conducted an exhaustive study last year of things that make health systems in developed countries different from one another. They determined, now listen to this, that the U.S. is distinct in a few ways. But the clear finding of those researchers was that this huge gap in prices, more than any other single factor, not the number of doctor visits or hospitalizations, not the quality of medical services, not the differences in social service spending, it was the cost of going to get these kinds of services, that was the most expensive place. And that was the reason why we are not able to bring in and rein in the cost. It's not about coverage. So we've been sold a lie as we continue to sort of hide behind the truth, which is these prices that nobody wants to tackle, Stephen.
So, I mean, but in some ways, that just begs the question, right? Why are our prices so much higher? And if you look at that, I wish you could share a chart on the radio.
Yes.
But I have in my mind sort of a chart looking at comparative healthcare expenditures per person across the nations of the OECD.
Right.
And you will see that we far and away spend more than any of those other countries per
right.
person. But what I think is the most important piece is how we spend that money. And that is almost half of total health expenditures in the U.S. are through the private sector, right? That's why our prices are so much higher. We have an entire for-profit industry sitting in the middle of our health delivery system whose only function is to extract money and arguably generate paperwork and deny care.
Okay. So I'm going to give you another story. So I'm looking at the Maine newspapers this morning. And in the Maine newspapers, Maine is about to introduce legislation that is going to put a cap on the price of insulin. Now, wait a minute, it gets even better. And they talked about the fact New Hampshire is also thinking about introducing legislation to put a price on the cap for insulin. And I'm like, wait a second, that's just one freaking thing. That's insulin. So this is how we're approaching healthcare and pricing, Dean. We are actually passing legislation state by state about one damn problem,
It's a response to media coverage. So there have been a lot of stories about you know, families who are sharing a single dose of insulin you know, people who perhaps are getting sick as a result. And so, you know, it's kind of a piecemeal approach. So something pops up on the radar and then people try to address it.
Oh, when I saw that, I'm just thinking, okay, when does my drug come up for a piece of legislation? I mean,
state do you have to move to?
Exactly. But what a stupid approach. If I were running for president, I would be holding up that legislation and saying, whose medication should we have next? It's kind of like a GoFundMe, except it's a go legislatively fund me.
The cost of, I think it was EpiPens went up at one point, several hundred percent. And so everyone focused on that, right? And the surprise billing, too. Right?
Unbelievable. All right, I got to get into 2020. I just got to get into 2020.
So before you do, throw in one other data point there? Because I think we're missing the other part of the equation.
Give me a million.
It's not just sort of how we spend the money. Yep. It's if you go to opensecrets.org, which sort of filters FEC spending data, the second largest industry spender on lobbying in the U.S. after banking and finance is health and pharmaceutical industry, right? Okay. Part of the reason the ACA was structured the way that it was is that Obama learned lessons from Clinton, right, which went right at the insurance industry, and Obama sought to buy off the insurance industry, right? I'm going to give you 20 million additional obligated customers if you stay out of the way and don't impede our progress here. Right. That is the structural impediment sitting at the heart of the system that is going to get in the way of anyone's effort to create a more rational system.
Oh God, I'm going to slip my wrists. If you go to my Facebook page, everyone, my personal one, not for the attitude, but for mine, you'll just start reading. I mean, today I've been like a Gatling gun. I mean, every single post has been the increase in the cost of premiums in the last 5 years, the increase in deductibles in the last 5 years, the average. I mean, every single one. I'm just going. And here's the problem: because the media doesn't ask the questions, because the media is also controlled by the same deep pockets of the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. I said we need to arm ourselves with the facts and the numbers. And every time we're in a public setting, we need to bring it up. When we're with a candidate, we need to bring it up. If a newspaper reporter talks to me, we need to shove those numbers right in their face and say, I want that in print. Not what Big Pharma told you to print, but what I'm telling you is my reality. All right, I got to go into 2020. So here I go. Tell me why Joe Biden is number one. Tell me why Joe Biden, they think, is number one. Let me just say something. Joe Biden, I am just
I'm just smiling because you guys have been trying to write him off for 10 or 11 months.
No.
He's still number one.
Exactly.
Don't say anything.
I'm teasing.
I'm in therapy. I'm in therapy. So I'm looking at Vox.com. All right, here we go, Mr. Spiliotis. Joe Biden explains why he said he defy a subpoena to testify in the Senate.
He changed his mind, though.
Come on, the impeachment. So first of all, let me just say something, Dean. He knows that the Hunter problem is a huge Achilles heel for him.
And he has not handled it well.
And he has not handled it well. He's in freaking denial. I mean, as if
he's
somehow.
Kind of, sort of.
Yeah. So, I mean, and everybody.
Really?
And
I think he wants it to go away.
But he wants it to go away. And to some extent, the other presidential candidates don't want to challenge him on it because, in part, it is the foundation for the impeachment against Donald Trump.
Sure.
I mean, the only contribution Hunter Biden will have made to America is that he was the reason why we are probably now impeaching Donald Trump. I mean, that is his greatest contribution. He may know of nothing about the oil and gas business. He may not understand understood that $50,000 a month for knowing nothing is pretty expensive, and that his father was the vice president in charge of Ukraine policy. Not that he didn't understand how inappropriate this was, but in a lot of ways, the 2020 candidates are afraid to challenge Biden on this, which in some ways is leaving him even more vulnerable if he gets the nomination.
Oh, absolutely. If he's the nominee, it's not going to go away.
So what are we doing? I mean, I don't understand why the Democratic Party keeps insisting that this is the package that will sell when this is a package that is, looks like a piece of Swiss cheese.
Or better yet, why doesn't the Democratic Party tell Joe Biden that if he wants to continue with their support, he's going to have to do something to deal with this. And I'm sorry, Dean, but just saying I'm not going to talk about it is not going to make it go away.
I don't think he's saying he's not going to talk about it. He tried that and it didn't work, but he still hasn't figured out a good answer. You know, the part of the issue is that, you know, the reality of how we the reality of our nomination process is it's controlled by the winning candidates. It's decentralized. So there's not all that much that the DNC can do. They can try to, you know, sanction delegates for states that jump the queue in the primary. But even that doesn't work. They end up backing down from that. So
come on,
there's not a lot they can do.
Well, the Democratic Party has had its thumb in favor of Biden for the whole year.
Well, let me just ask Stephen, is there a way for Joe Biden to answer the Hunter question? No, I keep thinking, will someone write me a script that I can then hand to Vice President Biden and say, Vice President Biden, here is how you frame it, here is how you answer it, and I will be honest with you, Stephen, I don't think there is.
I mean,
that's the problem.
I think there are ways to do it. I don't think there are ways that Joe Biden himself is likely to do it, but I mean, in some ways, tying back to the conversations we've been having earlier, right? There is nothing unusual at all or surprising about the sinecure that Hunter Biden achieved because of who his daddy was. This is the way in which large segments of the world function, right? Look at half of the Trump administration, right? It's relatives. This is old, well-established practice.
Oh, that's what the Ukrainians
said.
That's how we do business.
This is unseemly. This is untoward. It shouldn't have happened then, and it shouldn't happen in the future. I mean, this is Warren's argument, right? The anti-corruption argument. This is corruption that is so commonplace throughout D.C. and world capitals that we usually don't even notice it.
I get that. So here's my problem, Dean. And that is exactly what you said. Yes, it has been the way we have done business. The corrupt, inappropriate, conflict of interest, appearance of impropriety that we have done forever. The problem with that is he has to run as a Democrat and do that. It works fine on the other side. He's in the wrong party. If you want to celebrate the corruption, if you like the revolving door, let me tell you, the GOP ain't got a bumper sticker for you. The problem is, how do you do that explaining to millennials? Problem is, how do you do that explaining to the new people you want to bring into the system? I understand my family looked corrupt, but trust me, when I become president, that corruption will all disappear, even though I can't explain it. Dean, you tell me.
Arnie, I'm sorry, but the general election, the Trumps, regardless of their own guilt, are going to be all over Biden
it,
and they're going to be very effective.
Of course. No, I don't.
So it's not just in the Democratic
primary. No, you're not hearing me. I am saying that he has to run as a Democrat where he has an inability to explain that kind of behavior, because even if it's true that it's been pro forma, that's how we do it, it is really hard to explain it or to hug him close and celebrate his presence on the ticket. You're right, the Republicans will completely trash him for that,
if they do it themselves. Yeah, it's not going to go away. It doesn't matter. In some sense, it doesn't matter what he says.
So how does this weakness—
I mean, they're going to have to argue that, you know, look what you're comparing it to. And then they'll, you know, it's going to be this sort of, you know, each side pointing to the other side and saying, well, you know, look what they did. And then the other side saying, well, look what they did. And, you know, I guess they hope maybe at some level it won't be the decisive thing. You know, it may not be the decisive thing that people make a decision on when they vote in November.
So is there a way, Stephen, that he could slightly inoculate himself by an interesting VP pick? Now, let me tell you what I'm doing. I must be on drugs. I'll admit it. I think he should pick Bernie Sanders. Sit down. Calm down. Can you imagine two men in their 70s? Two old white men in the year 2020. And then running against another old white guy. It's just kind of shocking. But
and then the
I
third
am,
person in line of the presidency is also in her late 70s.
Right, exactly. So what I'm trying to think of, how does he deal with this issue? Because he still needs to be able to, even if he cannot confront Donald Trump on this and not do it effectively, in a bizarre way, a Bernie kind of is an inoculation against it, because look what he embraced. He embraced the opposite of who he is, which is a little bit of the Abraham Lincoln kind of approach.
I mean, I don't know. I think the idea that a vice presidential pick makes much of a difference is, I think, not particularly well borne out by the evidence. I think the irony here is, of course, that in many ways Trump's Ukrainian gambit has succeeded.
Yeah.
We are talking
exactly.
about the corruption of the
Joe
Bidens.
Yes,
and
yes.
the Senate trial is going to be focused on amplifying arguments about the corruption of the Bidens. This is the narrative that will forever ride underneath every bit of coverage that ever takes place for Joe Biden if he is the nominee. It's a very successful effort, albeit in a very backwards kind of way, on behalf of the Trump administration.
But, Dean, the shocking thing about when he was asked the question that, you know, if he was brought before the U.S. Senate on this impeachment trial because he was, you know, given papers, and that he didn't – that he's acted like this conversation had never happened in his campaign, that he'd never sat down with his consultants, that he never sat down with his wife or Hunter and even had this conversation. What this indicates to me is that in a way he's kind of still sloppy. In a way, he doesn't pay attention to detail.
Well, I was surprised when I saw the stories.
Right.
That said the initial stories where he tried to explain why he wouldn't show up.
Right.
And then eventually, obviously, he backed down and said, no, I would obey it. You know, he could have said right off the bat, yeah, I'll come.
Right.
But let's also have Bolton and let's also have Mulvaney.
Right.
We'll all talk about it.
Right.
But he didn't do that.
It's not his inability to figure out an answer. It's that I think this reflects a much deeper problem within the Joe Biden candidacy, which is I think he is not prepared for this. And I think he thinks that he is prepared, Stephen, but he's not. And the little bubble that he was in with Barack Obama for 8 years, while he may have been very engaged, he was never really confronted with kind of the rough and tumble challenges of the politics that we're seeing today. And I think in a lot of ways, his not only is his age showing, but his lack of understanding of how the political landscape has so dramatically changed.
Although it's unclear that that's new, right? Remember that he has run for president twice in the past and accumulated a total of zero electoral votes. Delegates, right? He's terrible at this. He's terrible at it. The peculiar set of circumstances and him being a recent vice president with the aura of Obama attached to him and a Democratic Party that is so busy trying to game out what they think voters want that they're afraid to actually figure out what the nation needs and present it, right, gives us an utterly sort of unqualified, inept candidate who may well wind up with the nomination.
Unbelievable. All right. My last story of 2020 for our Rethink the Week, believe it or not, I go to Australia. Australia's on fire, Dean. It's on fire everywhere. They don't know what to do.
It's pretty remarkable.
It is the story of climate change. And it is the story of climate change in a way that is just not even comprehensible. I mean, we don't focus on Australia ever. We don't ever have a sort of a handle on what's going on. But the country is literally burning up. And what I found fascinating was my daughter was talking about it. You know why? Because a lot of Chinese have bought a lot in Australia. They saw Australia as the place where they would want to buy the farm so they could eat their food. They would want to have the dairy because they would have their milk. So Australia is very much in the backyard of China. And she said, Mom, everyone in China is watching the flames in Australia and watching their investments burn up. Isn't that interesting? It's not only that I see it from a climate change perspective. They see it as an investment perspective.
Sure.
And they're seeing that it's lit a match to what they thought was going to be their sort of their safety location. It's an amazing story. And I'm just wondering whether this climate change story that the Democrats were afraid to have a debate upon will actually be maybe one of the biggest triggers for the 2020 election. No.
Oh, yes. You're asking?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm asking.
I, as I've said before, it certainly is within the Democratic Party. I still don't know that it is in a general election. All the polling data usually has it the highest third, fourth in terms of most concerning issues. But you know, all this is kind of part and parcel of you know, people understanding more about what's going on. I mean, these are very granted, it's a long way away, and
I know.
You know, Americans sometimes pay less attention to
those
kinds of things.
We're xenophobic. We know nothing outside of our borders.
So, but still, nonetheless, it's. I mean, every time I open up my phone, there are articles about just tragic about koalas and natural habitat and homes, and it's really sad.
And Stephen, people. They're not even – they can't even comprehend what they're seeing. I mean, it is such an intensive level that it is remarkable. But I saw a fascinating story coming out of one of the Miami papers. And for the first time now, there's a small, very wealthy community on the water that is now spending money and putting money aside to buy up property after property after property because they realize that they don't have the capacity to actually respond to the tragedies that will be happening. And it's one of the first communities in the United States that finally bit the bullet and said – and they're lucky because it's an affluent community, so they can actually find the cash. But what is their decision? Their decision is those houses can no longer exist.
And large swaths of Miami are going to have to be abandoned by the end of the century.
Right.
I mean, think of the stories we've seen just in the last year locally, though, right? Think of the wildfires in California. Think of all of the flooding that was decimating farms in the Midwest throughout the better part of the summer. I think that part of the challenge is I think the coverage has not been equal to the scale of the problem, thing one. I think two, and this is the much larger political dilemma, is that the scale of solutions required in order to effectively address the problem are so enormous and so overwhelming that it is hard for people to know how to think about it without some really competent help about how to think about it and what it is that we can actually do about it.
And, you know, I saw an article about there are a group of scientists, I think, at MIT have actually come up with a solution. And obviously it's very complicated. And obviously, but they actually see the potential for a really remarkable result. But one of the most important lines in this story was how many jobs that the solution would create. And we have always, packaged climate change in a negative job way. Instead, what this said was, let me tell you about the jobs that we will create. Dean Spiliotis, Stephen Pimper, what a wonderful 2019. I'm so glad I ended it with you. Thank you so much for joining us and enlightening us with your intelligence. Thank you so much. All right, bye-bye.
Happy New Year to you guys.
New Year. And we end with?
We're going to end with a song called My Hero by the Stereophonics, and that is for John Lewis, who today announced, unfortunately, that he has stage 4 cancer.
That you put in my life. I hear you sing.